Welcome to The Creationist, a podcast about people who create. I'm your host, Steve Waxman. Toronto's Massey Hall joins Carnegie Hall in New York, Royal Albert Hall in London, and Boston Symphony Hall as one of the world's classic concert venues. But as author David McPherson discovered while researching the history of Massey, the hall has hosted a plenty of, well, let's call them quirky events over the years, in addition to the iconic concerts it's been associated with.
You know, to find out, like, Winston Churchill gave a speech there, and, you know, after the Boer War, and Helen Keller spoke there, you know, they had boxing matches as another example, wrestling matches, opera. I mean, it really ran the gamut for a typewriter contest. So it's just, there is all these things that you'd never imagine or you thought of that happened in those buildings. I mean, prohibition rallies, or, like, you know, temperance rallies, all sorts of things like that. So I think that was kind of the neat thing, just to discover and find out.
In 2018, Massey Hall closed its doors for a long overdue massive restoration, which promises to bring the hall into the 21st century and at the same time retain its charm and restore some of its hidden beauty. Around the same time, David McPherson and his publisher Dundurn Press met with Massey Hall's management team to propose a comprehensive book chronicling its 125-year history. So, first off, how did you get the gig?
How did I get the gig? Well, I guess back up a bit. I mean, before this book, I wrote a book on the Horseshoe Tavern, and, you know, it did fairly well, and I always kind of thought, well, you know, what's next? And Massey Hall, surprisingly, I had thought about doing a book on Massey Hall well before I did the book on the Horseshoe. And then I discovered that this was probably 15 years ago or something, and discovered there was already a book that had been written to coincide with the centennial. And so I kind of put it on the shelf and didn't think much about it. And then, yeah, it was coming up to Massey Hall celebrating, you know, 125 years and getting set to close and have this big revitalization project. I figured, why not? After the, you know, success of the Horseshoe Tavern book, I love Massey. It's such a magical place. And, you know, I went ahead and pitched the publisher that printed my other book, and they were on board right away. And then it was same as with the Horseshoe book. I wanted to get kind of the owners on board to make sure it was kind of more the official book, that I would get access and their help and their buy-in and support. And so that's what I did. I mean, my publisher Dundurn and I met with you know, the folks in Massey Hall, and including the late Dean Cameron, early on, to get their buy-in, and, you know, just went from there.
Well, given that there was already the 100th anniversary book, why did you think that another book 25 years later was worthwhile, and why did the publisher think the same?
Well, I think a lot of it, once I started to dig back into that 100th anniversary book, I mean, it was a little more, I think, academic in nature. It also didn't really cover, you know, a lot has happened in the last, you know, 25 years at Massey in terms of their mandate and the types of acts and playing in the hall and that kind of thing. And there was a lot of stories, I guess, that, you know, I didn't think had been told, especially in, you know, the areas that I'm most interested in, obviously the kind of rock, pop, folk, indie, different alternative rock genres that I think could have been more well represented. And yeah, so that, I think that was the reasoning, that definitely there was a lot more stories that could be told. And also then when we got into it, as you've seen, it's a book that's also very photographic centric in many ways, and the photos help tell the story. And that was also something with this book that we knew it could be more, you know, have that feel where there's a lot more images and imagery that could be used that weren't in the previous book. So.
Well, when you say that other book was more academic, what do you mean? What does that exactly mean?
I just mean, I mean, I guess in the way it was written, it was from the point of view, it didn't have as many, it was very factual, I yes, maybe that's the way to put it. There wasn't a lot of interviews per se that were done. Whereas, you know, I approach this obviously first and foremost, my background is as a journalist and journalist training. So, you know, that's part of what I felt too could be all those voices that weren't in the previous book that I felt definitely would add to it, because that's really what Massey's about. It's a place that Hart Massey gave to the city of Toronto back in 1894 as a place for the people, and it's about the people. And I think all the artists and people that had attended shows there, you know, those kind of voices were missing. So that's what I said about doing too. I mean, I interviewed probably close to 100 people or more for this book, and you know, wove their stories throughout the various decades.
So, okay, talking about Hart Massey, for people that don't know the beginnings of Massey Hall, I mean, one of the incredible things, there's so many interesting stories about Massey Hall, obviously, but one of the incredible things is from the time that Hart Massey first mentioned it to somebody to the doors opening was only 2 years. So do you want to tell the story a little bit about Hart Massey, where he came from, and how he came to build Massey Hall?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Hart Massey was, he basically kind of took over his father's business. It was kind of in kind of agricultural farming machinery, and kind of took it to another level, really got farming implements patented and sold throughout the world, opened up a huge factory that was called The Works in kind of the west end of Toronto on King Street, and, you know, ended up moving his family to Toronto. And so that was part of it in the kind of late 1800s. He was settled there, and, you know, by that point, he'd amassed quite a fortune, and he wanted to give back. He was one of the early philanthropists that felt that, you know, money, you know, like the Andrew Carnegies and people like that, that it was their duty to, if they were to make all this money, to give it back to those that could benefit from it. And, you know, that's how it started, I guess. That the tragic side of it is one of his sons died quite early. I believe it was of typhoid fever, and that the gift of Massey Hall, because his son was quite musical and loved, you know, the symphony, and, you know, loved the choir. He sang in the choir. So it ended up that this philanthropic gift was in memory of his son, Charles, that had passed away. And, you know, that's what he wanted to do, is to commemorate him and his love of music with this hall for the people of Toronto to enjoy for decades. And he probably would never have imagined for centuries, you know, more than a century to come. So,
yeah. Okay. So jumping back to the present from the past, when you had your meeting with the publisher and with the folks at Massey Hall, were you given any kind of direction of as to what they would like to see in the book, beyond what your proposal might have been?
Not in that initial meeting per se. I mean, I think that's where we presented, you know, I obviously, like most authors, when you approach a publisher, you have to give an outline and proposal for your book, kind of chapter by chapter. And, you know, I basically had talked about different eras, different significant moments to focus on, that kind of thing. But it was more, I stressed, if you will, at that initial meeting, just like I did with the horseshoe. I mean, I've never been the type of writer, and I'm not the type of person that wants to do any kind of, you know, tell-all, reveal, like critical type analysis per se. I knew from the start this was going to be a labor of love, and it was, you know, it's not like I was going to gloss over any stories, but it was more that, you know, this was going to be something where I, you know, it was celebrating Massey Hall and what it means to the city of Toronto, to Canada, and, you know, to the broader kind of live music ecosystem these days, right? That it's important that we preserve these heritage buildings. And we're lucky in Canada that we still have a place like Massey that, you know, hasn't faced the wrecking ball like so many other buildings have in the past. So,
So how do you go about starting such a massive project?
Research, really. I mean, that's we talked about that previous book, and it really was my first point of research. It's a fantastic book. It's called Intimate Grandeur by William Kilbourne, and I believe it's probably out of print by now. But I mean, it came out in 1994 to celebrate the Hall Centennial, and it was a great starting point. So, you know, I had that book, and then also Massey Hall were very generous in giving me access to their archives, and so then that's where I also spent, you know, quite a bit of time going through, you know, everything that, you know, they had in terms of, you know, old programs and old minutes from meetings and various other ephemera and things that trying to start take notes and craft the story. And yeah, from there, then it was doing interviews with people, kind of coming up with a list of people that I, you know, a wish list, if you will, of those I wanted to interview that I know they had played Massey or, you know, recorded an album there, or for, you know, whatever reason, maybe they worked there, or trying to get different perspectives. But that's kind of the way I began, is just with the research, because that is one of the keys to any project or book like this. That's where you really have to begin, because then that helps you also find those stories and kind of see where it might lead and how kind of all the pieces connect.
Well, I mean, chasing down the artists is one thing. At least, I mean, you can look at the itinerary and see who played here and chase down those people. But with regards to finding the employees over the years who had impact, how did that happen? How did you know who to talk to, and how were you guided to the right people to talk to?
Again, that's where I was lucky to have the help and support of you know, the leadership at Massey Hall that knew kind of you know, the Dean Camerons, you know, that has unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But, you know, he was very helpful early on, and knowing people who had worked there in the past. Same with Jesse, who's now the current president. You know, he'd been at Massey for a long time. So he was able to, you know, help me out in that regard. And then there was promoters were another key that they were someone I didn't kind of think of for some reason when I was doing my horseshoe book. But I mean, they play a big role in terms of concert venues, and, you know, so that was another person or that I made sure I wanted to get involved in this story, like people like Elliot Lefkoe, who you know, started promoting shows at the small clubs in Toronto and has gone on to, you know, much bigger places, but, you know, he still presents shows at Massey and other venues. And you know, the Rob Bennetts, who promoted shows, you know, throughout the, you know, 70s and 80s, 90s, the Bernie Finkelstein, Bernie Fiedler. So I think that was part of it too, getting kind of, you know, their stories of all the shows they promoted there and all the artists that they'd worked with, and, you know, make sure I got that perspective as well.
What shape were the archives in when you got your hands on them?
Well, surprisingly, I mean, it's like a lot of these places you'd expect they'd have such great archives. But at some point in time, unfortunately, I think Massey's, some of their archives were destroyed by a fire, but the rest of them were in really good shape. I think that was more just kind of from like in the more recent period. But it really was in off a parking garage in Roy Thompson Hall. They basically had a, you know, a play of...
Locker room,
basically, yeah, that just housed, you know, all these boxes and boxes of stuff. So it was very well organized and easy to access. But yeah, in terms of, it wasn't like a, you know, a fancy room or anything, or so it was surprising. But, you know, it was amazing the type of stuff they had. As I said, I mean, they had old programs dating back, you know, for the TSO, dating back to the turn of the century. And they had, you know, Cats costumes from, you know, when the Hall host, you know, had Cats, the musical run there for a 7-8 month run there in the late 80s. So, you know, it was neat to kind of dig through that stuff. And
to that end, what were some of the unusual things or things that you found that you didn't know that you would find that got you really, really excited on a particular day?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, as I've told other people, the big thing with Massey is a lot of people just think of it as a concert hall. And I think that's the thing. You know, I had a bit of an understanding that it had played host to so many other events and over the years. But once you dug into the archives and did research in newspapers, and that's where another one of my sources was to going back in the old Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Toronto Telegram archives, you know, through the various libraries. But, you know, to find out, like, Winston Churchill gave a speech there, and, you know, after the Boer War, and Helen Keller spoke there, you know, they had boxing matches as another example, wrestling matches, opera. I mean, it really ran the gamut for a typewriter contest. So it's just, there is all these things that you'd never imagine or you thought of that happened in those buildings. I mean, prohibition rallies, or, like, you know, temperance rallies, all sorts of things like that. So I think that was kind of the neat thing, just to discover and find out, you know, beyond the concerts. I mean, for myself as a concert lover, I mean, that later on to see, oh, wow, I didn't know so-and-so played there. I mean, in the 70s, 80s or whatever. But I think that was kind of the coolest part, if you will, and just all those surprises of how many different types of events, you know, have been hosted inside those doors. So,
you know, there's also a number of iconic moments at Massey Hall that maybe not everybody knows, but people have heard of, whether it's Caruso singing to the people off the fire escape, or the, you know, the live jazz recordings that were made, you know, back in the 50s that became groundbreaking recordings. Can you talk a little bit about some of those iconic events that you cover in the book?
Yeah, well, I mean, you touched on one of them. I mean, the jazz concert, you know, back in 1953, I mean, it's one of those things that when it happened, I mean, it was put on by, you know, the local jazz society, and they didn't really do a lot of advertising. The promoter was sure that he could get the place filled with word of mouth, and it was barely even half full, but it ended up being the only time that, you know, these five jazz greats, you know, that ended up becoming known as the quintet, Dizzy Gillespie, it was Charlie Parker, Max Roach, who were the other two? It was, I'm going to remember it in a minute, but it basically, long story short, is, the other one, I think, Powell, that's who I forgot to mention. Yeah, Charles Mingus and Bud Powell. You know, it was one of those that the thing wasn't even sold out, and but then this record was made, and then, you know, this mythology around it just got created. And, you know, since, it's been kind of dubbed as the greatest jazz concert ever, right? And so a lot of people who maybe never have heard of Massey Hall or don't know about it, they've kind of found out about it through this jazz show. And then I think from there, because of the acoustics and the intimacy of the place, it's always been known for a great room for sound from the artists. There's been so many records recorded there. Neil Young in 1971 did his Live at Massey Hall record that only came out much later in time, as you know, from your time at Warner. I think it came out during that period in the, you know, later 2000s. But I mean, then you've got, I mean, Burton Cummings recorded an album there. Rush did All the World's a Stage, a big album there in the 70s. Gordon Lightfoot's recorded there, Blue Rodeo. So, I mean, it's that in itself, I think, speaks to, you know, what a special place it is. I mean, these artists, you know, would it choose that venue to record their records in if they didn't have such respect for it and knew what great sound they were going to get out of that recording.
Well, you bring up acoustics, you bring up the great sound, you relay a really awesome story about 1961, I believe, where the acoustics were tested in a very unique, well, it seems a very unique way. Can you share that story a little bit here?
Yeah, no, that was kind of a neat story. Yeah, again, that they were trying to test the acoustics, and they brought this, you know, this expert in, and yeah, he had this pistol that he used to, you know, let it go off, and just to hear, you know, how that sound echoed and reverberated. I mean, it was a way to tell what incredible sound is in that building. But part of the revitalization over the last number of years, I mean, that's something that there always were issues that, you know, certain spots in the hall that didn't sound as great. And that's where they, again, they brought in a, you know, a world renowned acoustician to kind of do all these studies and work with all the other people doing the revitalization to make sure that they could bring the sound up even more, because that was the one thing. You talked to all the artists, and they were all, a lot of them, some of them afraid, you know, the Jim Cuddies and people, okay, what, you know, just don't mess with the sound, right? And so, I mean, I can't wait to get in there for my first show and to hear what it sounds like, but I'm confident that, you know, everything they did, it was about respecting the past and not changing it, just enhancing it where they could and making those tweaks, you know, whether it was in the seating with new seats that are better to absorb the sound, or, you know, in the walls, the restored plaster, things like that, that, that will all help the way the sound is, you know, comes back to the stage and out to the audience to give an even greater listening experience.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I obviously, before I read your book, I didn't know a lot of the history prior to the first time I stepped into Massey Hall in the mid-70s. But walking by Massey Hall, you always saw the stained glass windows on the outside. But when you were inside, you never saw them. And it's interesting that, you know, to your point about acoustics, how they were constantly working on acoustics and sound bleeding and how they covered them up. And now people are going to be inside Massey Hall and see them again for the first time in almost over 100 years.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be spectacular. I mean, I know, you know, right before Dean Cameron, you know, the former president who was president of BMI for many years before that, I mean, I think he was able to see the stained glass, you know, either being removed or put back in. And, you know, that was a really emotional experience for him. And I know it will be for anyone that goes in there, because like you said, these are stained glass that were created, you know, well over 100 years ago, and they've been boarded up. And the reason was for sound, in a way. It was sunlight and also for sound of the horse traffic in the early years that, you know, it was hard to hear the shows when, but now they've got new technology and whatever that they've been able to both get experts to refurbish these stained glass windows, put them back in, but allow that, you know, the sound issue won't be a factor. And I think it's just going to be spectacular. So I can't wait to see those the first time I walk through those three red doors again. So
when did you start putting the structure of the book together? Was it the structure that it has right now is fairly chronological? Was it going to be that way from the very beginning?
No, to be honest, it wasn't. I think partly, I mean, with my last book, I did it chronological for the most part. And maybe that's why I thought, oh, I gotta do things a little differently. And, you know, maybe I'll do things a little by theme or sections that different chapters that kind of relate by theme, if you will, or like a different way. And thank goodness for editors, because that's really had a fantastic editor, Allison, that I worked with on my last book and this book as well. And she's the one early on that helped kind of restructure and realize that, no, you know, you've got to do a chronological. And that really helped me kind of focus more too and tell the stories and fit the stories in where they best, they work best. And also the idea of having sidebars and things, I think, because I'd interviewed so many people and that was part of it. Sometimes I'd have a quote or something. I didn't quite know, well, where can I fit this in? And I think that was a nice thing with a book like this. It was easy to say, okay, well, let's pull that quote that Geddy Lee or whoever there says about the building, and we can, stick it in as a nice sidebar that fits well in this section. And again, that's what a good editor brings. They help us writers, see that bigger picture sometimes and see how those pieces fit, when we're just kind of putting the words on the page and not seeing, the structure. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the fun of the book, too. Geddy Lee telling the story about seeing Cream for the first time in Massey Hall and then having a ticket stub there from that particular show in the book was really, really cool. I also like the way, you talk about sidebars where you tell stories in whole as opposed, there are some stories, obviously, that are just little segments that are throughout the book, but there are other more important stories that are told in whole as sidebars so that you could get the entire story in, such as the story of the Dylan concert with the band, where, Robbie Robinson came home for the first time and found out that they were going to, or got booed and didn't unexpectedly.
Yeah, and that was a challenge, but I think that's what, again, made it easier to get some of those stories that I felt, like you said, were worth including and not like condensing or watering down, if you will. It was a way to allow those voices to speak, on their own without me having, to try and weave them into the bigger narrative. So,
yeah, certainly. And certainly, those of us from a much younger generation, I think, will learn a lot about it being the home of the TSO and it being the home of the Mendelssohn Choir and really how important those two entities were to Massey Hall over the year, basically sustaining it over the years.
Oh, definitely. I mean, they were some of the earliest tenants and some of the longest tenants. And you're right. In many years when there wasn't a lot of other acts or music or performances that were coming through. I mean, something like the TSO, they had the regular subscription series and regular shows, and same with the Mendelssohn Choir, that every year they had, many, many shows, including their annual, Messiah show at Christmas. And, until the TSO moved to Roy Thomson Hall when it opened, in the early 80s, it had been there since kind of, I think almost over 60 years. So definitely the Toronto Symphony played quite an integral role. And that's a neat thing too, that a lot of people you talk to, maybe that was their first experience with, Massey Hall, going to see the symphony with their parents or grandparents or something, before like you or I going to see a rock concert, right? I mean,
yeah. And also, that then Gordon Lightfoot became, you couldn't separate Gordon Lightfoot from Massey Hall for the 130, 140 times that he's played there over the years. And then, Blue Rodeo playing there several dozen times, Neil having played there several times, and how important that venue became to Canadian artists and how it became a bucket list stage for Canadian artists. And, Bare Naked Ladies, it became a home for them for a while as well. And I think, I think that's what's really great too. The book brings us to, current times, talks about how important Massey Hall, the stage at Massey Hall, became to showcasing Canadian artists. But also, you go into great detail about how Massey Hall is bringing up young artists and cultivating their career, helping them cultivate their careers so that they can potentially get to the Massey Hall stage.
For sure. Well, because that's another part of Massey Hall a lot of people don't think of. They just buy a ticket, go to the show, and, they love it as a fantastic concert venue. But Massey Hall, Roy Thomson Hall, as an entity and an organization, is a not-for-profit. And part of their mandate is about artist development and community outreach and education. And so those were, I think, key, telling this story. I wanted to make sure that piece was told as well, because you touched on it, that you have artists like you know, the Matt Mays and Serena Ryders and, you know, Matt Anderson, Ron Sexsmith back in the day, White Horse, all these bands that, you know, they started off playing smaller stages. And a number of them, folks from Massey Hall actually worked with them and came up with a long-term plan or strategy. You know, how are we going to get you to Massey Hall? Like one of those, okay, we're going to start, you'll play your first show at, you know, the Rivoli. Then we're going to move up to the Glenn Gould Center, then the Winter Garden. And eventually, I think you'll have built up the audience that you can play Massey Hall. And I think that's a fantastic story in itself, that they are supporting all these artists and staying with them in their careers. And if you talk to any of them today, that's what they'll say, is that, you know, they hope that they'll be with these artists, you know, throughout the long haul, like, you know, as long as like a Gordon Lightfoot, you know, that they'll still be playing there, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, if their career allows it. And the one other neat thing is, I mean, you mentioned it, how it became a bucket list place. And the one thing that Jesse, the current president, Kumagai, told me that I thought really resonates is the idea that Massey Hall, it's one of those places that it's artists aspire to, right, on their way up, as we talked about these artists wanting to play there. But the people like the Neil Youngs and that, surprisingly, they reach a certain level, but they still want to play there, right? So it's kind of, it's that neat, you know, sweet spot where, you know, even though you've achieved such stardom or fame or such a huge audience that you've moved well beyond the theater of Massey Hall and you could sell out arenas, there's still, you know, people like Neil that would rather come back and play 3-4 nights at Massey than play, you know, Scotiabank, you know, down the road kind of thing. So I think that's kind of a neat story too.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, I think back in the mid-90s, Bryan Adams played a week at Massey Hall when he could have been playing Maple Leaf Gardens. And that was such a huge event in the city that an artist that big at that time was playing at Massey Hall for 2,700 people a night as opposed to playing for 20,000 people.
Yeah. Well, I remember talking to Randy Bachman, and that was kind of a point he made. He said, I was always jealous of Lightfoot and Neil and Joni and all those guys that, you know, they get to play Massey for multiple nights. And, you know, I never played there until many years later because with the Guess Who and BTO, they kind of rose and skipped the kind of theater stage, right? They went right to selling out arenas. And he kind of always said, I would have loved to play Massey Hall. So I think that's kind of neat that, you know, here's an artist that, you know, has achieved a lot of fame too. And he went on to play Massey later on and different, but just that fact that, you know, artists at so many different levels still just love the place. And it's kind of even, you know, I don't know if you recall from the book about Stompin' Tom or that when he kind of came back out of retirement a bit in the early 90s, I mean, he'd always want to finish his tour at Massey, right? And I think a lot of artists too, that it's kind of like the homecoming show or the culmination of a tour. It's like, what better place to kind of wrap things up than at Massey, right? So
did you know about the programs that Massey Hall and Roy Thompson Hall had, the public programs that they had before you started working on this book?
Yeah, I was aware of them a little bit, but not to the extent, especially more the community outreach and educational programs, because that's really newer in the last 5-10 years, and those programs are fantastic as well, you know, that where they get artists to bring in a school group as an example, or go to a school and to teach them about recording, or they write a song together, and then there's another really neat program that they've kind of adopted, I think, from Carnegie Hall, this lullaby program where, you know, it's a mother and her newborn, and same thing, they match them up with an artist and they write a lullaby for, you know, the mother to sing to her baby, and they record it. You know, so I think, again, it's all about, you know, giving back to the community a lot. And that's the theme that really resonated. And I started out this project with, if you will, with as my thesis, Hart Massey's original vision that Massey Hall is a place for the people. And once you see all these programs that they're doing, and you realize that it's kind of continued what he wanted for the place, As I joke, I think he might be rolling over in his grave if he knew, you know, bands like Iron Maiden and AC/DC and had played there, or maybe some of the stuff that had gone on backstage and some of those, you know, rock shows in the 70s. But I think he'd be quite happy that the place is still standing and it's still giving back to the people, right, of Toronto and, you know, Canada, really, with the arts and entertainment and education, you know, everything that we've noticed in this pandemic that still lingers, that people crave, right? We need these outlets, and we need the arts, I think, more than ever. So I think it's we're lucky that places like Massey still exist and, you know, are there to serve the people and offer these great programming.
Whether you've only been to Massey Hall once, or if you've enjoyed dozens of nights at the venue, the experience is one that you'll never forget. I have so many fond memories of my own, such as seeing Elvis Costello there in 1978, or LL Cool J bringing the first full production hip-hop show I ever saw. I sang, poorly albeit, with Brian Wilson in one of the tiny backstage dressing rooms, and I saw AC/DC for the first time in 1979. As a matter of fact, a photo I took of singer Bon Scott that night is included in David's book. The plan is for the lights to turn back on at Massey Hall this November. Naturally, the first live show will be with Gordon Lightfoot. When the total renovation is finally finished, in addition to a refurbished concert hall, there will be an expansion next door called the Allied Music Center, which will include a state-of-the-art recording studio, a nightclub, a performance theater, and collaborative workspaces for artists. In the meantime, David McPherson's book chronicling the history of Massey Hall is in stores in early November and is available for pre-order now. I hope that you enjoyed this episode of The Creationist. Please follow and rate the podcast. It helps us find new listeners. If you have any suggestions for future guests, you can reach us at thecreationistpodcast@gmail.com. The Creationist is mastered in post-production by Paul Ferrant. I'm Steve Waxman, and I created this podcast. The plan is for the lights to turn back on at Massey Hall this November. Naturally, the first live show will be with Gordon Lightfoot. When the total restoration is finally finished, in addition to a refurbished concert hall, there will be an expansion next door called the Allied Music Center, which will include a state-of-the-art recording studio, a nightclub, a performance theater, and collaborative workspaces for artists. In the meantime, David McPherson's book chronicling the history of Massey Hall is available for pre-order now. I'm proud to have contributed a bit to the history myself, sharing a photo of AC/DC's Bon Scott from that night in June 1979 when the band made their Toronto debut. I hope that you enjoyed this episode of The Creationist. Please follow and rate the podcast. It helps us find new listeners. If you have any suggestions for future guests or just want to say hi, you can reach us at thecreationistpodcast@gmail.com. The Creationist is mastered in post-production by Paul Ferrant. I'm Steve Waxman, and I created this podcast.